So tonight I'd like to offer some thoughts on the theme of renunciation. And just to remind myself and all of us that all of the Buddha's teachings are intended to point us towards the end of suffering. So the words themselves only point, and really encourage you in listening to the talk, to really let it be an opportunity to listen, perhaps in a different way than we often do. You can just stay in a sense with your own presence, stay connected with your body. If it helps to close your eyes, feel free. And that sense of letting the words, letting the teachings kind of pass through you and see what touches, what resonates. And see what touches and what resonates, and trust that will be something that will stay with you, or you can come back to if you need to, and to very much just let the rest of it go, and afterwards we will have some time for some conversation. And when I've been preparing this talk and I've been reflecting on this theme for several months, as quite a priority. And one of the ways I wanted to frame this evening was as a kind of a conversation about renunciation, because I've been reading and reflecting and practicing and thinking and so on. And so I've kind of feel like I've had some conversations with various teachers that I've been reading, and so, and then we can broaden it out perhaps to be a conversation, among all of us, as to what is this, and what place does it have in our practice, and why is it so important in the Buddha's teachings of freedom and compassion? Why is it such an important component of the path of understanding suffering and how it's caused, the unnecessary suffering that we experience, that is so much created in the mind, and really, really seeing and knowing that, knowing release from that. And renunciation, this letting go, giving up, putting aside, going forth, all of these possible meanings of renunciation. Interesting, I think, for me, in talking to people about it as well, a sense of, renunciation. it's not a very yum-yum topic, maybe. I don't know how it strikes you. And that the reactions, I've got to give something up. Well, yes, I don't know that. The sense of the connotations of deprivation and constraint, and I don't know if that's there for you, but I think, and in a way the discomfort of maybe around, well, actually, part of this exploration brings you much more in touch with actually what you are attached to, and the degree of attachment and the depth of it and the pervasiveness of it, and it's like the craving and the clinging and how much it's going on so much of the time, and so I suppose part of what I want to say at the beginning is that if we can bear the discomfort of that, it can be tremendously liberating. Because we really, it's like you get to be really honest about your life and really see, where you're stuck and where you hold on. And that actually there is a way, there is the path of letting go. There really is the possibility of that. And the kind of happiness, you know, that nothing that we hold on to could provide. So just wanted to hold out a kind of vision. And also let this be, as with all the Buddhist teachings, you know, this is not an idea to go, I'm renunciate, I'm going to be really renunciate, I'm going to really... And, you know, we may kind of have images of that or aspirations of, you know, to that, but that it's really, it's a very kind of practical, moment-to-moment kind of here and now. Like right now, you might think, you know, what am I holding on to right now? I don't know, something in the mind, you know, some idea of what should be happening, or, you know, sometimes it can be very, very subtle, can't it? You know, it's like, I feel okay, but actually I'd like to feel a bit better. You know, or just interesting, isn't it? If you just look into yourself right now, it's like, what is there that we're sort of maybe holding on to? You know, we wish that bit of our body would feel okay, or so much of what renunciation is sort of pointing to is trying to sort of, it shows up this relationship we have to experience, isn't it, where we're not really just like mindful in there. It's like there's an agenda, you know, we're like trying to fix it or push it away or, you know, get more of it, or, you know, and actually we don't see it happening, and so we don't realize that that's so much the source of our suffering, and that part of the real pathway of practice is learning, I'll say more about this later in the talk, the sort of learning to really know in our body, in our mind, in our heart, in our molecules, what that activity is of grasping, because it's not obvious sometimes, and it's so instinctual almost, isn't it? It's a conditioned and patterned in. This isn't something we choose to do. We don't go around, right, I think I'll do some craving today. Right, I'll go and crave for this. Now I'll crave, you know, it just happens, doesn't it? We just find ourselves kind of drawn here, drawn there, you know, it's like, what's going on? So this is a very deep inquiry, and it takes a lot of patience. But again, maybe you have a sense of that in your own life, you know, that actually when you can really know that, you can feel, oh, yeah, there's the possibility of not being so much in the clutches of that, in governed by that. So, you know, I know for myself that... yeah, this can be a sensitive area, so encourage us all to be, you know, to be gentle with that. And of course, sometimes we don't get a choice, do we? Sometimes things are just taken from us, and then, you know, so to practice letting go, a hugely compassionate thing. So I wanted to read something from the Dalai Lama, which was one of the inspirations for this talk. So he says, renunciation is the first step to thoroughly determining how vulnerable we are to suffering and recognizing the mental afflictions that make us so vulnerable. So you're recognizing the nature of suffering, but you're also sensing the possibility of emerging from this ubiquitous, you know, all present, everywhere present, vulnerability to suffering. And this is why it's called the spirit of emergence. So I'd like to offer you this idea of the spirit of emergence, of somehow allowing ourselves, finding out how to practice through meditation, through ethical commitments, you know, through inquiry and investigation, to let ourselves kind of rise up out of that kind of mire, kind of web of vulnerability to suffering. And maybe we can, as we go through the talk, perhaps what that is will become clearer. So one of the things that struck me actually just, I think it was today or yesterday, as I was going through trying to prepare and thinking that everything that I found really challenging in confronting, say, you know, attachments and cravings and clingings, was that actually right there is also wonderful, like, opportunity or invitation to let go, with the awareness and that courage to look. So just some very just brief examples to try and ground this a bit in experience. So just recently some of us had a week-long retreat together, and I was really aware at sort of the end of all this lovely sense of community and tenderness and care that had grown up over the week, and just sort of in leaving that, you know, a little bit of clinging, kind of, and it was kind of, that's okay, you know, but just sort of being aware of that, and so, okay, it's all right, just get in the car and go, and I'll see some of them next week. And it's okay, it's all right, you know, and so much, oh no, I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't be feeling that. And when my beloved foster mum died, I had a lot of experience of both that sort of really clinging, you know, really clinging and the suffering in that, not wanting her to die. I mean, how dim is that, you know, it's like, you know, she's going to die, of course. But no, you know, and how am I going to survive? And these things that are, you know, come up for us, and just how much suffering there was. And then those moments when actually I could just be mindful, I could be with that, I could be with the feelings, just sit in the room with her and hear the sounds and see. And it was okay. It was okay. You see that there isn't, it's like there isn't any absolute. It's okay, it's not okay. What changes? Can you feel, you know, you feel that? We feel that in our mind, in our body, you know, it's like there's some, oh, and it can happen in a moment, can't it? It can happen in a moment. It's like what something was completely not okay, and we just, and then, oh, and it's okay. And it's like that's part of this practice. So, with regard to this, of course, we have the wisdom of impermanence, you know, that can really help us, or what helps us with renunciation. So, you know, in both of those situations, it was something about also opening to the wisdom of impermanence. William Blake, this beautiful thing, if you know, he said, "He who binds himself to a joy doth the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise." Yeah. So that sense also of when we're with something lovely, you know, when we can really just let it be something that's just arising, passing, and we can really be present, and there can be the joy of that. Apparently William Blake was a really happy person. Had a big family and made this amazing art, was quite poor, but was apparently very, very happy. So this obviously, you know, kind of goes with how he was. That we can just practice with even the little things. Just the being able to just let things kind of touch us and be gone. And I sometimes feel like I went on a beautiful walk today, and I could sort of feel like at the end of it, that it'd almost been like a whole series of little mini graspings, and at the end of because it's so lovely, it's like, oh, that's you know, and there was some tension then that kind of builds up. So it's kind of interesting, you see the subtlety of it, and how it's like in renouncing that, in letting go of that kind of reactivity, we're not actually rejecting the world, we're actually opening up to it even more. So, another idea, another practice that's so helpful with this is contentment, cultivating contentment. I don't know how that sounds to you. One of my nicknames for a while was the malcontent, so I hope I've kind of grown a bit through that. You know, the sense of just, you know, everything's just not quite right all the time, pretty much, you know. It's just not, either in here or out there, you know. And what it is to actually practice contentment. Actually, you know, right now I feel okay. You know, nobody's hitting me. I mean, you know, this is, it's so powerful, and it's so helpful with our cravings and always wanting something else, you know, it's always got to be something else. Sayadaw Upandito puts this extremely strongly. This was one of my, I think this was another one of my challenges to sort of, in exploring this topic, because I don't know if how it sounds to you, but it's quite, he says, all of us are slaves to craving. I said, really? It's okay, think about this. He says, it is ignoble, but it is true. Desire is insatiable. So there's, in a way, another framing of the problem. But again, when we sort of meet that, we go, ooh. And then, you know, with great compassion, he goes on to point to, again, one of the answers, which I'm trying to do. It's like you see the clinging, and then you sort of see that the possibility of practice, a release from that. So he says, if we understand this correctly, we will not seek satisfaction in this self-defeating way. And this is why the Buddha said that contentment is our greatest wealth. So, there is this very, very human activity that we're pretty much all involved with, most of us, maybe a lot of the time, of seeking satisfaction in things. Now, people, places, events, objects. And in that sense, it's kind of endless. And so again, how do we step out of that? And obviously the first step is, in a way, to say, oh no, okay, yeah. I kind of confess, you know, the slave to craving. It's like humility, kind of honesty, you know. Then you get to see it operating in your life, and then you get to possibly do something about it. And so, that the really, really key thing here, of course, well, one of the key things is to not judge ourselves for it, because this is everybody. And it's so, you know, if we just then use it to stack up evidence to, you know, oh, I crave this and that, oh dear, you know. No, it's great. It's like, it's almost like there's this, I don't know if you can kind of get a flavour of that. In practice, you know, when something becomes fun, I get to spot the craving, you know. Play spot the craving. There, I just invented a new game. Take a day, you know, and just make that your main focus. Oh, that's going to be fun, actually. I might try that tomorrow. So, another challenge that came to me while I was exploring this was put very well by Stephen Batchelor. And he says, self-centered confusion and craving are embodied in the very economic, military, and political structures that influence our lives. Yeah? So, if you sort of take up that logic, and so that means that everywhere we go, virtually, we're going to have something like mirroring our craving to us. Yeah? And there's a lot of it about, and it's like, I was on the bus, you know, earlier, and I was noticing, you know, these adverts that come up on the screen, and how the is a sale for something, and the price was sort of going, woo, woo. You know how they do that? The little circle around the actual price is going, woo, woo. And you feel a bit of your brain going, woo, woo. So clever, isn't it? You know, these advertising, they're very clever. So everywhere we go, you know, we're sort of getting those messages, and how it meets them. You go, oh yeah. So it's very important, I think. You know, that sense of the mindfulness of cultural messages. I was reading 6 Degrees, you know, the English magazine in Helsinki, and very interesting, some useful things. And I found myself going through all the events, you know, and it was like, oh my goodness, that's interesting, all this wonderful stuff going on, you know, and think, well, I really should here. I mean, I was thinking, I'm not here very long, no, I really should go. So then some should comes in, that's something else. slightly different, and just, you know, and then kind of putting the paper down and thinking, actually, I'm really, really happy just sitting here in this lovely flat. A Sangha member very kindly offering me his flat, lovely, lovely, quiet flat to sit in. And I just realised I was so happy just sitting in this flat, looking at this white walls, you know, and enjoying the silence. And it was really interesting, you know. And that's, you can sort of, don't overlook that, isn't it something? Because we're so habitually running around doing this, that and the other thing, that actually it's this thing of what really makes us happy, you know. That kind of happiness which is really includes our whole well-being, you know, it includes our deepest aspiration, it includes all of us. It's not just the sort of, you know, this dog off a leash who's just like running around going, you know, like this, you know, I don't know if you ever feel like that, but. So that was a kind of an example of that. Let's see, where are we? Right. So the conversation continues with different teachers. Ajahn Tanisaro, I know some of you know something of, says, so the power of attachment is deluding and dazzling us. Because as we act out in repression or indulgence, the actual process of attachment remains unconscious. Okay, I'll just go over that again. So, if we have a desire, you know, for something, and we just repress it, or we just act it out, both ways, the actual mechanism of that desire is not known. Because we just do it, we just get it, or we just go, you know, nope, not having that thought, not having that. Right? So that, both of those avenues sort of lead to suffering. So what we're asked to do is this sort of middle way, you know, sitting here in, like in the meditation as earlier, it's like, okay, can I learn to be present with what is happening here and now? Yeah, I mean, that's it, isn't it? We just stop there. It's like, that's it. Learning to know. And when we can actually, something can be known, and then it can be not necessarily acted on, it's more choice, and that in a way is what we're trying to expand our capacity to do that, you know, because some things may be easier, some things more difficult. And I was thinking about how this comes up on retreat, you know, or maybe just when you're sitting as well, you know, it can be like you go to sit on your cushion for half an hour if you come on a retreat for a week, and it seems like immediately, you know, the agendas of attachment are revealed. You're sitting there, you think, oh, I just really need to go and check the computer. Or, oh, I forgot to ring so-and-so. You're kind of like twitching, you know. Or you get on retreat, you know, and the first day particularly, you know, you might be like, oh, I really, really, really need some cheese, you know. I don't know, whatever it might be. So one of the really important sort of things about renunciation, like when you give something up or when you like step aside, like to sit on your cushion or go on a retreat, is that you're going to get to feel and see, yeah, the cravings and the kind of, you're going to get to see that. And that can be really kind of challenging and difficult until we realize there's a way of sort of releasing that energy through awareness and releasing that energy through kindness, releasing that energy through mindfulness. We don't have to, we're not so driven. You know, the driven, the push. I mean, even really kind of not very strong, that sense of being pushed by things. We can feel that. We can actually learn to be with that. So another area I wanted to touch on, this was in a conversation with a writer called Mark Epstein. And this is something of the renunciation and how it might operate again around our emotional life. So he says that renunciation of clinging, or letting go of clinging, is the first step of grieving the pain of the past. The pain of the past. Now, I found that very, very interesting, and it made me think, okay, can you see, maybe, you can look into your experience and see, I think it's often the case, that when you want something, you're trying to keep hold of something, it's actually, there's some pain of some kind that you're trying to get away from. Some discomfort, maybe very mild. Like, you come into the house, it's really quiet and silent, and there's something about that that's faintly disturbing. So you just put the radio on, put the TV on. What's happening there? It's really interesting. It's almost like, okay, so if we sat still, I mean, obviously sometimes it's a lot more extreme than that, and I think, you know, probably many of us know in different ways. Sometimes, you know, there's certain sorts of emotional pain, grief, loss, anger, sadness, fear, that we do not want to feel. You know, we've learned sort of different ways of repressing it, getting away from it. And so we have all these habits, these things and places that we go to sort of get away from that. And so what he's pointing to is that sometimes that renunciation actually is the doorway to coming to terms with losses, you know, with grief. And actually realizing that if we allow our heart to feel the grief, it's okay, we can move through that, we can actually move through that, it can be transformed, and that energy that's been so held and locked down and avoided and turns out to just be this energy that when it can move through the heart, when it can move through being held with kindness and compassion and mindfulness, actually turns into just life energy that's then available for us. I want to give an example of this in my life. Once I received a really critical letter, you know, a letter really criticizing me. And, you know, some of it was certainly had some grain of truth in it, but it was just really unpleasant. And it set off a lot of emotions in me. And I could really see how I was trying to avoid that and just getting into busyness and things. And that when I actually, over a period of some time, you know, kind of turn more to that, the fear that came up for me in that, and then it turned out that there was quite a lot of anger, and then moving through that, and finding that sort of at the end of all of that, there wasn't, it's like nothing had been gained particularly, but some sense of something having been released, something having been processed, something having been transformed. And maybe you can think of the examples of that in your own life, when you have the courage and the resource, which of course is what we're building in meditation, sort of resource to be able to do this, or we have help from other people, that, oh, you know, there can be, maybe gradually, maybe suddenly sometimes, there can be this release. So really, when we're caught in craving, you know, really looking at the kind of emotional sort of underlayers of that, sort of feeling what's under this, what feeling am I avoiding, you know, in acting out in this way. So another thing that came up about this, which I thought was kind of more of that area of how sort of renouncing boredom, renouncing that whole kind of way that we have of dulling out about our life, and everything's just, you know, kind of grey, and what's the same, and it's the same bus I was on yesterday, same job, same people, same, boring, let me get out of here, the craving arises. And there's this term in English, I don't know if this makes sense to you, of familiarity breeds contempt. And there's something that happens when you're familiar with something, and it just somehow you just stop kind of really respecting that because it's so kind of familiar to you. And I was thinking about how through meditation, through mindfulness, you know, we can really learn to live with that kind of letting go of this idea that anything happens twice. You're on the bus today, this is not the same as yesterday, you know, it's different. It's a whole other moment, it's a whole new moment. And the power of mindfulness to sort of really bring this incredible freshness and kind of wonder to life. Very small example today. I was watching this man with a digger, you know, big machine, big wheels, big, you know, scooper thing on the front. And he and his colleagues were putting earth down, you know, they're improving a part of the way, wherever it is, I don't know where I am, somewhere, along the water. And I was watching him, and it was like a ballet or something. It was just, that's slightly overblown way of putting it, but the way he was picking up this earth, and then the machine itself was obviously incredibly sophisticated and could do these really delicate movements, and then he was handling it so beautifully. And it was like putting the earth down and then kind of moving it and then jiggling it and then smoothing the earth out with this like really delicate little kind of almost like stroking the earth. It was really amazing. Mm-hmm. And then kind of, and then the other men came and raked it. It was just, I wish I'd have, I should have been brave and gone and just said like this. But they probably would have thought I was crazy. Mm-hmm. I did smile at the guy in the digger. So I think because he saw me kind of going like this. So I hope he didn't. And then he smiled, so I was glad he didn't think I was like being critical or something. Actually, the funny thing was about the end of that story was that he was being a little bit less than careful with the bush. A little bit of the bush got smashed, but because he was. And I just thought, well, there you go, you know, nothing's perfect. But for me, it was, you know, one of those moments where it's just so ordinary. It's like, guy with a digger, so what, you know? But actually, what the care that was going into that. And it helped to, it was just a very enriching little moment. And I know sometimes, like, going somewhere new, it can stimulate that. So the challenge is that we, you know, when we go home this evening, all the little things, the bus and the amazing, you know, just everything is amazing, and that we can really live like that. It doesn't have to be kind of twee. Marcel Proust said, "The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes." Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you feed on? This is thinking, what do you lean on? No, how does your clinging and craving behave? You know, all sorts of things, isn't there? And I think a really helpful place to work is kind of with those things now: food, gadgets, no, time, being time alone, time with the other person, with others, no. TV, internet, travel. You know, don't have a lot of possessions, but boy, do I like going here and there and everywhere. Exercise. You know, it's so interesting, like, on a plane, you know, for like 9 hours, you know, stuck in a seat between two people, can't do much exercise, you know, and realizing, you know, yeah, oh, what do we lean on? You know, and seeing how anything that we really depend on is sort of, we're bound there. You know, our freedom is limited. Can I just sit in that airplane seat and be happy, even though I can't exercise for 9 hours? You know, that's a challenge for some of us. Becoming, this other kind of craving of, you know, sometimes our craving is around, I want to look good, you know, I want to be great, you know, I want to, you know, be clever. Or I don't know what it is for you. It's like sometimes it takes a little bit of investigation. I want to be a kind person. I'm the person people know as kind. It's very subtle. It's another form of craving, yeah? Wanting to appear a certain way, special. And again, not to judge that, but can you see if it's like, oh, okay, wanting to be special. Okay, arising and passing. Can you see what's on the other side of that? There's such freedom, such peace. And needing to be safe, you know, whatever it is. And then Vibhava, this other third kind, which is really important, of the craving to get away from, And I was just kind of like, don't look, you know, I'm hiding. You can't really see me, can you? You know, I'm not really here. You can't really hear my voice, you know. Or, you know, kind of running away from things. Or also aggression is kind of wanting to kind of get rid of something, get rid of things. I'm going to make it, you know, get rid, go. The frustration, the way that it can, craving, so craving can manifest in that way. And it's really, really important to kind of acknowledge that, because I think for some of us the vibhava, the reverse craving, is the most predominant that we'll notice in our experience. Like maybe for some it's like around fear. We're just like frightened of everything. So our whole life can be like this kind of, you know, process of make barriers. Very, very, very strong pattern, I think, for a lot of us. So, last thing I want to make out of all of this, and it's probably much more. Again, I think this is a series of talks, really, not just one. Can you see maybe that how a sense of self, a sense of me, a sense of who I am, maybe different ones at different times, is being reinforced by wanting, by if I could just get rid of these two things are keeping each other going somehow. It's that if I'm trying to get away, you know, because I'm a bit anxious and I'm always trying to get away, I'm feeding the sense of self that is afraid. Can you see that? Does that make sense? If I'm always trying to get and wanting, like going and getting this and get, yeah, I can get that, I've got these, look, I've got all those and I'm going to get some more of those. We're feeding a sense of self, yeah, that's, I'm the one who can get. Now that's maybe okay, but what happens when you can't get? You know, what happens when it all falls apart? Or what happens with the fear-based thing when it actually doesn't work? You know, you get hurt anyway. It doesn't work. And I think to see that, and to see that investment that we have in being somebody, in this trap of self-improvement, you know, I'm trying to get better, and then, but then in trying to get better, I'm reinforcing the I who needs to get better. You know, this may take some real investigation, inquiry to see. And again, it's like if you begin to see this pattern, this game, this circle, you go, oh. But when you see it, it's like that very seeing is, in a way, the freeing from it. Because if we're seeing that, then what is it, or who is it, that sees that going on? So we can renounce those patterns and those ways of thinking about ourselves and the world, and we can learn to unhook in different ways, to see it, to know it, so that nothing that we can think about ourselves is really who we are. It's just a thought. When you really, really investigate that and really sort of keep kind of inquiring into that in the moment, it's very, very liberating. So I know that's a lot, so thank you for bearing with me. I just feel like this is such an important and powerful way of practicing, and I would really encourage us all to have the courage to find different ways of practicing with renunciation. You know, it could be all kinds of ways where we can experiment and be playful, you know, like spot the craving for a day, you know, or, you know, practice being generous and see what happens again to your sense of self, and I've got to have, but what about me, you know, and you could use generosity as a renunciation practice. Giving things up for a week, you know, as a person who gave up I don't know how they did it really, but a mobile phone, internet, TV. For a week. You know, maybe you can't do that because of work, but maybe you could say, okay, I'm only going to do email, I'm only going to, you know, you could try, you can make experiments and see. Because one of the reasons I think this is so important is that our energy, the energy of our life, you know, of our precious, rather brief, very fragile life, what is it being used up by? Is that what we really want it to be used up in? Yeah, so we can, through renunciation and making these experiments of stopping, seeing what happens, seeing the attachments and loosening that, we can actually free up our energy to do what we really want to do, to think about what we really want to think about. And when we don't want to think, we can kind of put it down. So it's freeing up our energy for what is really most important to us, kindness, you know, silence, creative expression. You know, it could be many, many things. And to see that if for each one of us, you know, we're all different really. I mean, we're all the same. It's that paradox, isn't it? We're the same and different. But each of us, we have a kind of unique suchness about us, don't we? And the conditions of our life, they're all slightly different. And so to see that in practice, in meditation, and in renunciation, that's that exploration and the way that manifests is going to be different for each person. So not to have images of how I should do this, but to really take on what is really what we sense as being really helpful for us, or what is really of interest. I'm trying to stop, honestly. I have this wonderful quote which I actually read to you last time I was here, and I said, oh, I should read something different, come on, you know. I said, but it's so good and it's so relevant, so I'm going to read it anyway. This is a quotation by Thich Nhat Hanh, a great Vietnamese Zen master. So he says, go back to the present moment. Become more fully alive. Don't run anymore. Go back to the here and now and get in touch with the wonders of life that are available for nourishment and healing. This is the basic practice of peace. We have been running after the objects of our desire, but we know that our running has brought us a lot of suffering. We have not had the chance to live, to love, to take care of our loved ones, because we cannot stop running. The Buddha advises us to stop. So may each of us practice and live in a way where we can align ourselves with the truth of life and the truth of who we are. And may each of us really know that joy of being, that joy of contentment. And may each of us know the end of suffering. Thank you for your attention.